Okay, let's talk a little bit about your flying experience. I don't know a pilot that doesn't remember that first solo. It's the first time in the year all by yourself, and maybe you've been working for an instructor, for hours and hours, and it's the first time alone in your airplane. Tell me about that. What airplane was it? What airport?
When I joined the RCF, we did the solo on the Chipmunk, which is a...
Explain to people what that airplane is.
It's a small airplane, a Gypsy Major engine, fairly small engine, but it was fully aerobatic, and it was a much easier plane to fly than the Harvard, which was the next step up, which they used to start them on the Harvard, but the dropout rate was too high, so they got the Chipmunks, which was easier to fly. And
then they were able to transition.
Yeah, you could relate it to maybe the Cessna 150.
Okay.
It was a little more... durable as far as aerobatics, the Chipmunk. And then we went on to the Harvard airplane and flew that a couple hundred hours. And then we went to the T-33s. All the classes stayed together, and then we'd get our wings on the T-33. So we're pretty versatile at that time. And then we branched off into heavies or fighters or back instructing. Well, I went back instructing, and we were not happy about that, of course. We wanted some action over in... And the Korean War was just ending, so we weren't going anywhere there. But it was okay. And I instructed for, as I said, Mike, for 6 years or so on the T-6, and then I went to the C-45s, which is the Beech-18 twin engine, and we had F-86s to fly. Keep our morale up, and so I broke the speed of sound in the F-86.
Tell us about that. The first person to break the speed of sound. I'm trying to remember the gentleman's name. It escapes me. But anyway, I had a chance to interview him years back, and it was quite an interesting interview. And breaking the speed of the sound for the first time. What was that like? I mean, what was going through your mind?
Yeah. Well, I think it was a third trip in the F-86, and it was quite a little checklist you had to go over with the instructor. And we climb up fairly high. The thinner air, the better it was. We go up about 37,000 or so. And the F-86, of course, was fairly hard to get it through the speed of sound. Compared to the jets today, they can break the speed of sound just after takeoff.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to get the nose away up and then do a complete wing over. The nose had to go straight down towards the ground to get it through.
Just to get through that speed.
You couldn't glide it down at a 45-degree angle or anything. You had to get it straight up in the air and drop the wing and get it going straight down. And then as you got close to speed of sound, you'd get the shutter. And you knew you were right on it, and then boom, it was gone. You're just still.
And then you knew
and
you
then
were over.
Sort of, you're looking at both my wings here, you know. and then when you you'd bring it out real slow and come out about 15,000 feet or so and ease it out, and that's all it was to it. Back on the ground and head for the officers club and have a few beers with the guys.
Say, yeah, we survived that one, huh?
Yeah, and then you belong to the what they call the Mockbusters club.
Okay.
Which means you broke the speed of sound.
Now, I know you when an airplane breaks the speed of sound and you're on the ground, you hear that, you hear that sonic boom. Now, do you hear that when you're up in the air?
No. You just it was shutter, and then it was your.
So it's a buffet. Still. The airplane shaking.
Yeah, the shock waves leave the airplane and then they hit the ground, and it's a big sonic boom. Yeah.
So how much time in the 86?
Not much, maybe 100 hours or so, just when I was instructing. I wasn't instructing on the F-86, but they had them at the base.
Okay.
Because.
So what was the time span that you were working with military?
I instructed the whole time I was in there, six and a half years.
Yeah.
And I was getting out at 5 years, and then the Cuban crisis came up. And they froze all the releases, so I stayed in for a while after that.
Okay. Let's move along now, and a lot of, I'm sure there'll be people that, listen to this recording, and they're gonna, it's pilots that are on their way up, maybe instructing or flying for the regional airlines, and they want to get into the big airlines, the United Airlines, and American and Southwest and some of the others. What was that interview process like? Back then, and how has it changed over the years?
Well, there's been a lot of changes in the hiring, of course. When I was hired, we took a lot of courses in the military, you know, and atomic, biological, chemical warfare courses and all that, but we didn't need a degree as such in those days. Now, of course, you have to have a degree and quite a bit of flying time. We had a lot of time. I think I had over 4,000 hours when I got out. But there was quite a shortage of pilots in those days, and they were hiring people with basically 200 or 300 hours. I remember the females that we had very little time because, you know, the government said you have to hire so many, and they were fine. But now it's different, and they need quite a bit of flying time. I don't know, it's 1,500 hours or something like that.
Yeah, and they just raised it because of a few of the accidents that occurred, and it was kind of interesting. Not as low-time pilots as you would have thought, but nonetheless, they raised those hours. So it sounds like it's kind of history's repeating itself then, because you were going through the same thing then, you know, bringing in people that had lower hours because of a pilot
shortage.
And we're hearing the same thing now, right? The regionals.
I think there's going to be a massive shortage of pilots in the country here coming up 5-6 years because they're reaching that 65 age mandatory retirement. And I think the 1,500 hours is way too much. There's no reason to have that much time to get on. 1,000, fine. Because you get a lot of training on the airline. Mm-hmm. You don't just start out as a captain.
Well, it's constant training, right? I mean, you're in a simulator, every 6 months, something
like
that?
Just to give an example, when I first came with United, I flew the Viscount. We were dual qualified on the Viscount, which is a turboprop, four-engine airplane, and the DC-6, completely different airplanes.
That's tough.
Oh, it was awesome. And I think the first trip I flew on United was a two-day trip, okay? It was the best for days off. It had 18 days off that month on that. I think I'll bid this one, okay?
Mm-hmm. And what Bob's talking about, the bidding process, when airlines are looking at their routes, they have a bunch of pilots and they bid routes, so they say, I'd like to fly this route, and it's based on seniority, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, that particular trip, just to give you an idea of the experience you gathered real fast, 9 stops the first day in the Viscount, through ice, snow, crosswinds, ILS approaches to 200 feet, 9 stops. Sometimes the weather was great and it was easy, but we were young then.
Yeah.
And 9 stops the first day, then we laid over in Detroit, and 7 the next day, okay, 16 landings in 2 days. We did that 4 times during the month. So that's a lot of flying time right there in the landings. I mean, it's like 60, 70 landings.
So the new guys that are flying the regional jets that are doing multi-legs a day, they don't have any right to complain then. with nine legs a day and seven legs a day.
And then the union got it changed to 7 max, But the regional carriers, where the guys start, they fly in some awful weather too. I mean, a lot of the, of course, as we advanced to the jets, and then I checked out on the 737 as a co-pilot, and went up the line on the DC-8, DC-10 as co-pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a captain bid after about 13 years. I got a captain bid, and then you go back and start over again on the 737s. But it's all, you don't have to do that. You can retire as a co-pilot, which a lot of guys did. But
I think the most pilots aspire to get into that left seat, the captain's seat, and stay there. And when new airplanes come out, just like with new avionics, they want to, get behind it and fly it and learn about it and more life experience, right?
Yeah. But we flew in a lot of weather. I was based in Chicago, and, we were always in thunderstorms and snow and ice and all the rest of it, And you've got 100 airplanes coming into Chicago, and they can't vector you too much because they're so sometimes
you're going through it.
You had all those thunderstorms right on your nose with the good radars, and you were trying to get a little heading change, and oh, no, you can't do that. But they did a marvelous job. The controllers were absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, they still are. I'm amazed. I was in Chicago Approach. Was it the Tracon? I think it was the one of the facilities down there anyway, and got to sit with a controller for a while, and it's just amazing the amount of traffic that they get out through those gates and into the airport.
It really is, and you get used to it. The radios, you got to stay way ahead of everything, and even light planes coming in here, we broadcast our position 10 miles north, nobody answers you, there's nobody on the field, nobody flying around you. Hopefully there's sometimes you have guys that don't like to talk on the radio at all because they think this is a, an airport out in the Arctic somewhere. But
well, it's always good to talk because it improves the safety, right? Because then they can look for you. And yeah,
absolutely.
I know I call 10 miles out, and then I call before I'm going to enter the downwind and on downwind and base, and then the final.
Yeah, it's basic safety rules.
Right.
Yeah.
So then from the 737, you went to...
Well, as a captain, then I went up 727s, and then DC-8 as a captain, and then DC-10, and then on the 777, you know, which was modern, what they call fly-by-wire glass cockpits, you know, which is all computerized. And I hadn't flown the glass before, and I thought, boy, I'm going to have trouble with this school. And but I flew with a buddy of mine and went from Chicago to Paris with him. And I sat up in the cockpit, and he showed me a lot before I went to school.
Yeah, okay.
Because I'm really going to be terrible in this school. And that got me a little bit ahead. But it was a good seven. Every airplane you checked out on, Mike, was 7 weeks in training.
Okay.
At the University of the Air in Denver. Simulators that were exactly like the airplane, and they could present any runway in the world on it. Mm-hmm. Like the main runways that were sort of tough were Hong Kong and a few of them down.
And I guess what some people don't realize is those simulators are very, very realistic, aren't they? And it allows you to do things that you wouldn't normally do in the airplane from an emergency standpoint.
Exactly. You do all emergencies, and if you crashed it, of course, you're not hurting anybody, right? Mm-hmm. So they were fantastic. When I first went with the airline, the simulators were perfect. So you did training in the airplane, okay? Nowadays, the first airplane you fly when you get out of school in Denver, it's all simulators in Denver. The first airplane you show up at O'Hare Field, you're flying it with another captain.
Mm-hmm.
You've never flown that airplane before, and away you go from Chicago to Paris, wherever.
But it's always, you know, as the young guys are coming up, it's an experienced captain in the left seat, maybe a check airman, those sorts of things, correct?
Oh, sure, yeah. Oh, yeah, you'd have a check airman with you for, it wasn't that much time. He'd look you over pretty good, maybe a few, four or five trips, maybe, you know, and then you're on your own.
Yeah, so I think the U.S. has probably the best aviation system, you know, in the world, from training to air traffic control, and it's really the envy of the world. We don't, what we see, like over in Europe, there's been a lot of restrictions put on, you know, airplanes, and I think that hurts the overall ability of people to get into aviation and experience what aviation is all about.
Well, exactly, and... You have to really give these people credit today that get on the airlines, because it's quite a lengthy process now to build up your time, and it's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, as I said before, that it's way too much time. You shouldn't need that much time. If you're doing 16 landings in 2 days, you're going to get really...
But you're going to get really good, and the guy in the left seat's going to make sure you're okay.
And of course, you get on with the little regionals, which is great training. But that's, you're not making any money. Mm-hmm. So you have to have a rich daddy or something to get you through. That's a massive amount of money to get. That's 1,500 hours. That's insane.
So what do you say to the you know, the new guys and the new girls that are coming up through the system
today? You got to be motivated to do it. You got to stick with it, and maybe have a secondary job or something to pay your way through it.
Yeah, pay your dues.
Yeah, and but it's a little too much time because of the accidents they had. The main one was in Buffalo where that one crashed.
The Colgan crash you're talking about, right?
You see, that was... there's a lot of... The airlines, they're doing is... If you're inexperienced, you're just getting on the airline, they put them with a real experienced captain. But see, in that case... They didn't do that, and that would have solved a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
But
and you mentioned the DC-10 too, kind of an interesting airplane. I think they're still using the DC-10 a little bit for firefighting.
They are. Yeah. In fact, I saw one on yesterday. I saw one on TV pulling out of the fires in Washington State. I believe it wasn't that. Man, I love that airplane.
Yeah,
it was a great airplane. It was a little. It was a modern airplane in its own era there. But there's still a few around.
Yeah, it's there's some videos on YouTube. So if people listening to the podcast, you know, go over to YouTube and look at some of those firefighting exercises that they do with the DC-10. It's quite an eye opener. They can handle a lot of haul a lot of material, whether it's the water or some of the other retardants that they use while fighting fires. And then the DC-10, I had a chance years ago to interview a pilot from United Airlines that you worked for, Al Haynes, who he had a problem with a DC-10 in Sioux City, Iowa, where he lost the rear engine and it took out all the hydraulics. And he told me he was able to crash land that airplane in Sioux City, Iowa, and I think he saved a lot of lives. And that goes back to the training that you were talking about with the guys. And he was saying after the fact that they put some of the senior captains through that scenario in the simulator to learn from it. And he was saying there weren't too many people that were able to, to keep that airplane from crashing in the simulator. And I thought it was a lot of good things that came together, that day. He had a Czech airman that he brought up into the cabin, and he used all his resources. And I guess if there's one thing that I've learned talking to people like yourself that have done just about everything in aviation, is they use all the resources that they have and all the training and thought process to keep things safe in the air.
Yeah, without question, Mike, you have to use everything you've got. And even in the manual, it says you fly by the book sort of thing until you get in a situation where you don't want the book around, you throw it out the window and do what you have to keep that airplane safe. And that, I was flying the TAN when that happened at Al Haynes, and the co-pilot, it was amazing that they got out of there. They did a great job. Everybody think, well, they crashed. Okay, they shouldn't have been alive. Nobody on that airplane. It was an amazing job. I flew with the co-pilot a few months later, and he was very open about it. Sometimes when you have that, you don't want to talk about it too much. But he was, in fact, I was flying Chicago Honolulu with him, and so we talked about it quite in length. And also in the simulators after that, they duplicated that, and you had to do the best you could, and it was quite amazing because they told us in training years and years ago that there's nothing could happen. You would never have a hydraulic failure of that intensity ever.
Right.
So it did happen, and.
And they redesigned that airplane because of it, or made some changes at that time.
Yeah.
I think it was all the hydraulic lines came up in the tail right near that that engine.
Yeah.
So that was, in fact, I've got that interview, and if people are interested, we'll throw that up on the website too, so people can hear, listen to Al, talking about that. But years and years of experience you guys have had. So let's get back to talking about Washington Island a little bit. Why'd you decide to spend 6 months out of the year here on this beautiful island?
Well, we were looking for, I was retiring and we had a farm. We said, we'll get rid of the farm. We don't need that anymore. And I figured, let's look around. And I was flying Alaska before I retired from Chicago to Anchorage, and I took the wife along, and we were looking around there, and we said, okay, let's maybe think of Alaska, maybe to retire for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody told me about Washington Island. The fishing was great up here. They said, great. I'd heard about that before.
Mm-hmm.
Salmon fishing was great. So we came up here, and we loved it. We went back home and came up again about a week later. We bought a place. Wasn't too much of a house, but it was right on the water, and with docks and everything, so mm-hmm. we still live there now.
Okay, so you're able to get your fishing in then too?
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, I the other thing I did when I was a kid, I played a lot of hockey and actually was with the Detroit organization for a while, Farm Club Junior Hockey.
Is that right? Okay.
And then I joined I hurt my leg pretty bad, so I joined the military, and I played on the military team, and if I got hurt, it was fine. I'd just sit at the desk and work and still get paid. Whereas, you're a professional sports boy, I'll tell you what, you can ruin your life so easy.
Yeah.
Because you get injured and you're done.
Seeing that a lot in football, right, with the concussions.
It takes
years off your life.
But anyway, so I did play, even when I was with United, we had a team in Chicago I played for, and shouldn't have been doing that, really, because you lose an eye or something, same thing. But we had a little bit of insurance with that. But anyway, whatever.
But now, are you still active flying?
Okay, we have a flying club here, and there's about five of us fly.
Okay.
The one female who I helped, she instructed her over in Escanaba.
Okay.
We had to fly her over, and I flew her over a lot. I don't know how many times, maybe 15 or so, maybe more, 20. And I give her, and she'd have trouble with something. She's going to quit, I couldn't do these 45-degree bank turns.
Okay.
The guy was sort of a tough guy. He wasn't too friendly with the students, And
okay.
And I learned years ago instructing, you don't want to, the first time you even take a new airplane, okay, I've checked out on a lot of airplanes, and an instructor would say, okay, go ahead, it's your airplane. I said, no, it's not my airplane, it's your airplane. You're going to show me how to do this. So take off, do a circle, land it, and I'll be very happy to do the next one, because you don't want to scare a student. You don't want to put them in a position, my God, and then you start, oh, you're not doing this right, you're not doing that right.
Yeah.
Okay, show me how it's done before we even start this. You know, you demonstrate. And so anyways, if she'd have trouble with something, I'd pick her up here, and we'd do the 45-degree bank turns and do them until she was perfect. And we'd just laugh about it and joke, and we'd relax. She'd come back from her trip over here, and her hair would be standing straight up. This instructor's not treating you too good. But she got through, and she still flies it here. So
good.
And there's, I don't know how many fly now, about four or five.
Okay.
She'd lost quite a few.
So she did go on and get her license.
She did get her license, yeah.
Good. And that's important for people to learn, to realize, too. You know, sometimes in life you meet somebody that you just don't quite get along with, or maybe you're in a class and you think, oh, this instructor just isn't teaching me. And it's the same with flying, too. So at that point, get out and find another instructor and go fly with them, or find somebody that you're like yourself that has years of experience and can say, you know, maybe just settle them down a little bit and say, hey, you can do this. And
it's funny getting into that, because on the airlines and light planes too, it's quite amazing the difference between people. Nowadays on the airline, everything's SOP, everything's by the book sort of thing. You know, in the old days.
An SOP, standard operating procedures?
Especially with the big jets, you know, you got to, so it's sort of a different today. But I'd fly with a captain. If I was a co-pilot, I'd fly with a captain. I'd watch what he's doing. He comes in a little fast, puts the gear down a little late, whatever. And I'd do the same thing. Oh, and they think I was great, you know? Next captain. We actually used to keep a book on the captains. And this guy like this guy likes this guy. But they'd always fly the first leg.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
So then I'd sort of duplicate that. Nothing major changes, but little changes in. And they'd say, boy, you really know what you're doing, don't you? I said, yeah, I'm okay. The changing of the guard. But nowadays, everything's standard operating procedure.
So it's going to be the same. There's not that deviation from captain to captain anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. They had, some of them had pretty nasty names for some of the captains. Very few. Most of them were great. Most of them are just great. But.
And then I guess, you know, airports seem to be contentious in communities from time to time. And, you know, Washington Island has had their love-hate relationship with the airport here. What do you say to the people in the importance of the airplane to the, you know, in the airport to the community?
It's a safety issue here. The airport should be safe, but they're a complete asset to the town. People don't realize what an asset this is. People come in here and they spend a lot of money. They put out their pup tents by the airplane and they go downtown for 2 or 3 days. I mean, you know, I don't know the exact figures on it, but of course they have the fly-in, the fly-in that brings in a lot of money.
Yeah, for the Lions Club, right?
But yeah, the Lions Club, sure. Yeah. And but I can understand why the people don't like the airport, but. You know, and we always volunteer to take people off. If somebody's really sick, they pick up the phone, call me, and I'll be out of here in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You know,
take you down to the hospital.
We don't have a bigger.
In fact, there's some interesting articles on the website here about the you know, pilots such as yourself getting people off the island. One back in '69 was having a baby, and they took her off the island and got her to the Sturgeon Bay Hospital where she had the baby. And there's been, of course, you know, people that come down ill, and it's a great way to get from point A to point B quickly. So the other thing that I wanted to mention too, I think sometimes you run into people in communities where they don't. They haven't had that experience in aviation. So I always tell people, and one of the reasons we wanted to do this website is to meet some of the people that actually, you know, fly. And maybe if you haven't been up in an airplane, there's a flying club here, you're a part of it, you know, meet one of these folks that are on the podcast, say, introduce yourself and say, hey, I'd like to go for a flight around Washington Island. I don't know of too many pilots that would say, no, I'm not going to take you up. So
no, we've actually had taken up a lot of school kids too during the year. We try to have one day of that sort of thing, and yeah, people, I've taken people up. They want to go up and sightsee a little bit, you know.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for your time, and I've taken up enough of it already, and maybe we can get you back to talk a little bit about bush flying in Alaska. That's always been an interest to me.
Actually, it was in Northwest Territories out of Whitehorse.
Okay, Whitehorse.
That's an interesting story.
Maybe we can get you to sit down with us at a later time and go through some of that flying.
Sure, it'll be a pleasure.
All right. Thanks for making an appearance and spending some time with us here today.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks,
Appreciate
Mike.
Appreciate it. Thank you.